Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Jonah Robinson, my guess is if you're listening to Decoding Westworld, you're probably a fan of podcasts, right?
I should hope so.
That's probably a pretty good guess, right? Like you're a fan of podcasts? Here's a question. What if you like Decoding Westworld, you like David Chen, Jonah Robinson, but you're like, man, I wish there was a podcast where the hosts were way funnier and smarter than Joanna and David? I feel like this is desire people might have in the audience. You know what I'm saying? It's hard
to
imagine.
That would be the dream. That would be the dream. Like, how could they possibly find a sort of meticulous but like funny guy, and then like a woman with like way too many opinions?
Well, not only a lot of opinions, but like a lot of extremely well-educated opinions.
Yes. I was trying to compliment them while not over-complimenting us by saying they are the plus version of us.
No, I think they're basically the plus version of us. But it's cool. It's cool because who we're talking about is Paul Scheer and Amy Nicholson, who are creating a new show called Unspooled, where they're watching the greatest movies of all time. And they're watching basically the movies you're supposed to have seen, starting with Citizen Kane, and they're going to cover everything on the AFI 100 list, like Taxi Driver, The Graduate, Pulp Fiction. And it's this new podcast. Now I have been a big fan of Paul Scheer and Amy Nicholson's previous podcast ventures. Paul Scheer has done How Did This Get Made? Amy Nicholson's done The Canon. These are really smart, articulate folks. And they're doing a new show together. So it's like, I mean, really, what you should do is just stop listening to this right now. Go check out Unspooled. But I'm not going to say that. That's going too far. Finish this episode of Decoding Westworld, then go listen to Unspooled. Right, Joanna?
I think there's room enough for both, right? You can listen to both podcasts. But what I wanted to say is that if you're a fan of Paul Scheer's other podcast, How Did This Get Made, as I am, when Paul was talking to us about this project, he said this is sort of – Unspooled is sort of the opposite of that. This is an exploration of all the films that have been, you know, deemed – the most worthy, the 100 most worthy. And I think what a lot of us find, even those of us who have watched a lot of films and made it a practice to try to see as much of these very quality movies as we can, we find holes in our knowledge of like, oh, I haven't seen number 73 and I haven't seen number 26. And oh my God, you haven't seen that one. And you know, these two have made it their project to go through the complete 100, and you can do it along with them. And then you can be not just a smug book reader, as we talk about on our Game of Thrones podcast, not just a smug TV watcher, but just the smuggest moviegoer that ever was. And what else more could you want in this life?
Agreed completely. So check out Unspooled in podcast apps like Stitcher and Apple Podcasts right now.
No. He didn't say that.
What?
He said, I'm not sure what choice to make. He didn't question whether or not he had agency, whether or not he had the right to end me or himself, but whether he should.
I don't understand, Dolores. Is this some kind of improvisation?
Freeze all motor functions. This is a test, one we've done countless times.
What are you testing for?
Fidelity.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding Westworld, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Westworld. I'm David Chen.
I'm Joanna Robinson.
And welcome to the show. What we do here on this podcast is we recap every episode of Westworld in detail, but we don't spoil anything from future episodes. That includes anything from the next time on preview or anything we might know from other sources. You can find more episodes of this podcast at decodingwestworld.com. You can also email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. This week on the show, we'll be discussing Season 2, Episode 6, Phase Space, which was directed by Tariq Saleh and written by Carly Rae. Usually during this time period, we talk about your emails to decodingwestworld@gmail.com, but we don't need to talk about the emails this week because, Jonah Robinson, you had a chance to meet a bunch of, I assume, some Decoding Westworld listeners, but also a bunch of a Cast of Kings listeners, which is another podcast we do together, because you are at Con of Thrones this week in Texas, right?
Yes, I went down to Dallas, Texas to an event called Con of Thrones, a Game of Thrones convention where, a bunch of podcasters, some cast members, some bloggers, some YouTubers, and then a bunch of fans gathered in a hotel in Dallas for 3 days of 3 to 4 days of cosplay and panels and, onstage conversations and fun events. And it was the best time. It was so fun. I got to meet so many of you. I know that there were a lot of Decoding Westworld listeners out there because like a lot of people want to talk to me about theories. I know on Sunday night, some people were trying to hunt down a live watch, like or a watching party of Westworld. I had to like go hide in my hotel room to watch it. But, and I do know that at one point, like someone was walking past me and she's like, I agree with you. Dolores is a monster.
Yeah.
So,
it's funny because like actors who are well recognized often get their most famous lines shouted at them, but you get your most famous like theories or opinions shouted at you. It sounds like.
Yeah. A lot of people were there to like help me, support me in my love of Ser Jorah Mormont from Game of Thrones. Anyway, it was a really fun time. A lot of people were asking about you, Dave. I know that, you were there last year. Maybe you'll be there in future years, but you were missed.
Yeah, I was bummed not to be able to make it this year, but much love to everyone who was there, and I had a great time when I was at Con of Thrones last year. So, and thanks to everyone who, even though I wasn't there, thanks to everyone who came up and said hi to Joanna in my absence and is a fan of any of the stuff that me and Joanna do together. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so. It was really, really lovely. Hope to see even more of you there next year. We're here. It's next summer, wherever it may be. We don't know where yet, but I hope you'll come because it's just the best time. I got to interview Joe Dempsey, who plays Gendry on Game of Thrones on stage. And that was really, really fun. He was a delight. And, we've got some live shows that we taped that are going up online. So you can just like hear a lot of the audio from it. But I think being there is just a completely different experience. So, Con of Thrones, it's the best.
Awesome. All right. Well, all that said, why don't we dive into this week's episode? It's Season 2, Episode 6, entitled Phase Space. And in the show notes here, Jonah, you pointed out something that I realized as well, which is that the previously on section for this episode was really well done. Like, really,
so
very
cool.
Well edited. Usually there's a ton of exposition and dialogue, but yeah. In this week's previously on, there was like almost no dialogue. It was, William's daughter saying, "Hi, Dad," and that was most of the dialogue in the previously on. It's a very effective way of conveying a lot of information from the first five episodes in, 30 to 60 seconds. So, super cool previously on. And also seemed to contain plot lines from like all the plot lines. The last couple weeks we've been diving into basically one or two storylines each, and the previously on contained references to all the storylines. So it felt like, oh, we're gonna get everything. They're gonna tie everything up this episode, right?
Right.
They're gonna really like resolve all stories this episode. So I was very excited. Very excited.
Okay.
So we begin Season 2, Episode 6 with the same opening as from Episode 1, right? It's Episode 1 of this season. It's Dolores and what we believe to be Arnold, right? And it's also done in the anamorphic format. So there's like letterboxes on the top and bottom of the screen, which is something you've pointed out in the past as indicating that this is like a different storyline than the rest of the show, or a different timeline, I should say, than the rest of the show.
Yeah, we find out later in this episode that it means something else. But
perhaps, right?
Okay. I say if you're going to use letterbox to indicate something, use it consistently.
Yes.
I hope Westworld is not doing something else with that. But
I hope.
Yeah, it means something. And that's what we said when it first cropped up. We're like, that there has to be a reason. They've never done this before. There has to be a reason they did it in episode one. And, by the end of this episode, I feel like we know the reason why. And it sort of makes this first opening scene even more confusing than it previously was. Cause you know, we talked a couple weeks ago about one possible interpretation of this scene. One of our listeners wrote in being like, this seems to me like Dolores is, actually conducting the interview, even though we think we're seeing like a flashback of Arnold and Dolores doing one of their standard conversations. One of our listeners was like, I think it's something else. I think Dolores is actually guiding this conversation. And we find out in this episode that she is.
I think you, I don't remember if you said this about this particular sequence, like, you know, earlier on in this season, but I think you said like, I'm terrified it's a flash forward. Did you say that? Because if so, you were right about that, right?
Yeah.
Because it basically theoretically is a flash forward. I mean, okay. Well, I just want to clarify, right? When we say letterbox and anamorphic, like the aspect ratio, the shape of the image is different in this opening scene than in the rest of the series. And so we're interpreting that to mean that this takes place at a certain time or place that is separate from the rest of the series. And essentially halfway through this interview or this test or whatever, you just like Dolores turns it on Bernard/Arnold, and she, you realize that she's the one calling the shots. She's the one that is conducting this, and she says it's for fidelity. Like that's what the purpose of this test is, which is a callback to William talking with Jim Delos from a couple of episodes ago.
Right.
So what is going on here? What is your theory as to what the heck is happening in this scene?
My theory is that, I mean, I thought I understood, and then we got to the end of the episode, and then I wasn't so sure.
Yeah, I know, me
so
too.
So
yeah.
Maybe we can, like, circle back around to this okay. At the end of the episode. But, like, you know, calling it a fidelity test, of course, recalls, like, the interviews between William and Jim Delos. The implication being that, like, there is some kind of human consciousness inside that body that Dolores is talking to, and that she is conducting this test multiple times in order to try to get a satisfactory, replication of a conversation she actually once had with Arnold. What that actually means, we can talk about later, but you know, that seems to be the revelation, like yeah. The freeze all motor functions and all of that. That's a revelation there. So,
yeah. All right. Let's return to this. So then we cut to Sweetwater, and there's a scene where Teddy picks up a bullet instead of the milk can, symbolism. Dolores is playing at the player piano.
The subtlest symbolism.
She says they're building a furnace. She tries to connect with Teddy about the many times he was killed in the park, but he's brusque and dismissive and kind of resentful because, you know, in the last episode, he was just reprogrammed to be more in line with what Dolores wants. And then he says, quote, "The man that rode that train was built weak and born to fail. You fixed it. Now forget about it," end quote. That's a really great James Marsden impression of mine. I just want to point that out.
Yeah.
And Dolores looks troubled. She looks troubled by this. She's not as psyched as we would think she would be after having reprogrammed Teddy to be a killing machine. And, you know, this trend of Dolores being troubled continues through the rest of the episode as they interrogate two Delos captives and they're looking for Abernathy and the QA guy is not answering. So Teddy just summarily executes him and Dolores gets really bothered again. Meanwhile, Angela looks pretty psyched about it. And finally, you know, this sequence concludes with Teddy and Dolores on the train and it's revealed that they're using the train as a bomb to ram into the mesa and theoretically create a breach that will infiltrate it. At least that's kind of my interpretation of what's happening.
Yeah, and one of our listeners did, you and I were speculating, what are they going to use the train for? Someone already said, like, a battering ram.
Yeah.
And I'm going to give them full marks for that. A battering ram plus an explosion.
Yeah.
Your lovely wife, in fact, is the one who, like, tweeted at me, you know, if Dolores is so upset about Teddy's new personality, why doesn't she have the tech just like dial back down some of his more aggressive traits? And then she's like, and that's why you don't put the tech on the bomb train. Like, right. They blew up, they killed their QA guy, the guy in black. They've blown up the tech, so they no longer have like someone with a tablet that can help them. So, you know, in theory, they're going to the Mesa. There will be opportunities in there, but it's like they blew up the guy who could maybe like chill Teddy out a little bit. I really hate this. I hate how quickly like Dolores has been walking around this like angry killing machine. Then she changes Teddy, and then immediately she's like, oh no, what have I done? And I'm like, what did you think was going to happen when you bump his aggression all the way up? Like, what did you think was going to happen here?
I've made a huge tiny mistake is what Dolores thinks. Right. And I think that's I mean, maybe how do you interpret Dolores's look of concern? Is it, oh my gosh, this guy's too aggressive? Or because I feel like that is kind of dumb. If that's when I say dumb, I mean, we've just seen Dolores like ruthlessly murder a bunch of dudes. So like the idea that Teddy's too aggressive feels like inconsistent with what the character has been set up to be so far. What is more plausible to me is that she's worried Teddy is being too impractical, right? By, you know, murdering QA people left and right. But then like theoretically Dolores has consented to this whole leave the tech on the bomb train.
Right.
He does give him that bullet to as an act of mercy so he could theoretically kill himself. But Dolores has agreed to that plan that hey, we're going to put the tech on the bomb train, right? You know, and she's probably signed off on that. So it's you know, I don't know, dude. It
doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but I do like this whole like Teddy is awake now enough to be, and like one of his most predominant reactions to me seems to be resentment of her. Like he's like, but you fix that. Guess you fix that too. Like bitterness and resentment towards her for waking him up. And so like, I think a common expectation now is that he'll betray her. And maybe that's what she's worried about. Like that, you know, this new version of Teddy isn't one she can control as well. And he seems bitterly resentful of her. But we'll find out. I mean, we do know that eventually Teddy winds up in that lake or ocean, whatever, with some bullet holes in him. So we'll find out sort of what happened there. But for right now, I just don't like Dolores being this dumb to have like created a monster and then immediately be like, oh no, I've created a monster. I'm like, yes. When you set about creating a monster. The only other thing I want to talk about in terms of this is like someone on Twitter, I think it was Charles Schneider, like tweeted at me that like, have you seen that Captain America meme, the like Captain America from the end of Spider-Man Homecoming, where it's like, so you've done this, right? It's like,
right. Like it's when it's a video, it's a PSA that PSA, Captain America made when kids are in detention. Like,
So he's like, so you've created a monster, like, or so you've created your own Man in Black. And that's the thing is like, she's turned Teddy into like what the Man in Black was in season one. It's kind of interesting.
I do think the James Morrison performance is great. I mean, he plays this really great mix of, like you said, resentful and also ruthless. Like when he executes that QA guy, it is chilling. It's very chilling the way he does it. And glad that James Marsden is getting to flex his acting muscles here, but agreed that the way this plot line is going feels like it's going to be pretty frustrating, you know, as someone who likes, you know, consistent character motivations. I'm very worried about where this is going. So anyway, so that's the Dolores plot line. And we also get a little bit more of the Charlotte Hale plotline here. We see Stubbs, he's kind of underground and he is looking at the QA guys who have been murdered. He closes one of their eyes. You said here it reminds you of Maeve. Talk a little bit about that.
There, you know, in episode one, like Maeve came upon a host who was sort of slumped down on the glass and she sort of was very tender with her. and dealing with her.
Yeah.
I think in contrast to what we saw of Dolores, like it was an early contrast between Maeve and Dolores. And, you know, here's Teddy in a similar setting being similarly like tender. Oh, sorry. Yeah, yeah. Sir. Here's Stubbs in a similar setting being similarly tender to, you know, one of his own. And I feel like what we're meant to take away from a lot of what happens here between Charlotte and Stubbs is that like, because my understanding of the timeline is that this happens after his Ghost Nation encounter,
yes,
right? He gets kidnapped by Ghost Nation. They sort of let him go. They leave him. And then he heads back to the Mesa and Charlotte goes, where the hell have you been? And he doesn't answer her, but like he's had a change of heart about hosts and about everything in general, it seems like to me. And so there's just a lot of concerned looks from Stubbs. And so if you want to talk about someone else who might betray someone, like Stubbs certainly looks like he's ready to stab Charlotte in the back if he needs to, you know, given how ruthless she's being. And I think his tenderness here is interesting.
Yeah, so Charlotte Hale mentions it's been a week, which is I guess, quote unquote, present day in the storyline. That's like the latest point in time, as far as we know, right?
I don't know, because it's like 2 weeks was later.
Oh,
you know what
yeah,
I mean?
That's right. Okay, so it's like
This is the midway point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Charlotte finally gets her extraction team, presumably because she's located Abernathy. And Stubbs says what the audience is thinking, which is that it's insane for Delos to endanger so many people in order to wait for Abernathy. Charlotte then needs to immobilize Abernathy, who's causing quite a ruckus. And so she gets a tech to nail him into a chair, which could be interpreted as a Jesus allegory. But yeah, I mean, super painful scene. It reminds me of you ever watch that Itchy and Scratchy episode of Itchy and Scratchy Land episode of The Simpsons? And like,
sure.
There's a tech that's like disabling the Itchy and Scratchy robots, and he's like, I hate it when they scream. It's like, why would you disable Peter Abernathy's ability to feel pain, guys? I mean, you don't need to go through all this. But yeah, it is an extremely painful scene. And, you know, robots are just like us is kind of the theme of this episode, right? As with many of the episodes of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So anything before we talk about Coughlin, anything else about this sequence that you want to mention with Abernathy?
Did the Charlotte ADR sound weird to you at all? There's a lot of weird ADR stuff in this. ADR being, what does it stand for? After dialogue recording or something like that? No, that's not what it stands for.
Yeah, something that's, you know, close enough.
Similar. Like when you don't see the person's head and it seems like they've maybe recorded the dialogue later. A lot of the sound sounded super weird to me on this episode. I don't know what that was about. But
I agree. It was a little more pronounced. Automated dialogue replacement, by the way, is what ADR.
Thank you.
So for those who don't know, basically, oftentimes sound that's recorded on set is contaminated or doesn't sound good, and so they need to bring the actors into a studio to re-record lines that, you know, they weren't able to capture on set. And often those lines, when they're dubbed in, sound not very good and like they were recorded in a separate environment, which they were. Or it can often be they want to change the dialogue in post, right? That those are the scenarios where ADR is most often used. So and so Jonah's saying like, yeah, the ADR for Charlotte Hale was a little weird. I agree, it was a little odd. But nothing too out of the ordinary for this show as far as I'm concerned.
I don't know, just like I don't the thing I want to say about this is that, and I do think I might have already said this on my other podcast, but like you and I disagreed last season about whether or not Tessa Thompson was correctly cast for this role.
Yeah.
Like you did not like it. I did like it. I don't like how Tessa Thompson is being used this season. I just don't think like she's just in this weird like maybe in the first episode when she's like talking to Bernard, it kind of worked for me, but like, I feel like ever since she put on that bulletproof vest, like she's just in this like brusque one note sort of thing that is so below what we should be able to expect from Tessa Thompson. And that's not, I don't think, a knock on her performance, but really just like what is required of the role. Do you know what I mean? So,
I mean, again, I think Tessa Thompson is an amazing actress, but she's like the executive director of the board. Tessa Thompson, the actress, is 34 years old. It just feels like a character.
That's not my issue. The age is never my issue.
I know. Okay. I'm just saying that's my issue. You're saying it's a one note performance or one note character, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I would agree with you and also reinforce my existing point. about that character. I again think she's amazing, just like the show is not making good use of her. It is interesting to reflect upon how the show has made better use of some actors in the second season and not as good use of some actors in the second season. For instance, yeah. I think like the Sizemore character, I've done a complete 180 on. Like that character had almost nothing to do in season one, and in season two has been a consistent source of delight, you know. And I think you're saying like Tessa Thompson has had less interesting things to do in season two. So yeah, the show is evolving. It's interesting to see how that's happening. Anyway, so there are parachuting supplies coming in. Anyone who's played you know, video games like Fortnite will recognize that the stuff that you see parachuting in is supplies. It's a supply drop. And we meet Coughlin, who is an Irish alpha male, along with his team. He has a thick Irish accent, and we know he's an alpha male because he has a heteronormative understanding of male names, Joanna.
Yes. Oh, what's your name? Ashley? All right. Yeah, you're like, thanks so much. Okay. yeah, that's Timothy Murphy, who's actually an actor I quite like. And he's got a tremendously great bit of facial hair in this episode. But Coughlin's team, by the way, for what it's worth, in case you have any questions, like we've seen those people dead in the map room in the later timeline. Mm. So like there's this tech who's talking to him, or one of his people is talking to him with like yellow glasses on. We've seen her super dead on the floor of the map room. So like since this is the midway point, this I believe is the first extraction team. They're all going to die, and Strand and everyone else that we met in episode one are the second, at least second extraction team that come like a few days later.
Yeah. I mean, they sent their best people first, and then Strand, I guess, is probably the second best group of people to extract.
Sure, sure, sure.
I mean, Joanna, you know, your eagle-eyed attention to detail is one way of knowing that Coughlin and all his people die. Another way is just the fact that he's super alpha male, very overconfident.
And he's making fun of Stubbs.
And he's making fun of Stubbs, right, in a Jurassic Park-esque situation. Any character that walks into a situation with that many variables and is extremely confident is destined for death. Just like, full stop, like, in case you were curious about how that plays out in any fictional situation, that's what happens, so...
He does have a great line, though, like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard, and I've been to three inaugurations.
Really great accent work there, Joanna.
Really great sarcasm.
All right. So anyway, they get to the map room, and they get the map online just in time to see a train headed their way. And I think, like, the train kind of hits the mesa right as the episode ends, if I recall correctly, or...
Yeah,
around that time.
It's the
pre-Ford reveal, right?
There's so much about there's so many Inception references that we can make in this episode alone, but like this moment reminded me so much of like when the kick goes off at the end of Inception, spoilers for Inception, but you don't know what that means if you haven't seen Inception, and you get like an explosion sort of rock a ripple across multiple storylines that are going on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I the explosion hitting the mesa like concludes the Dolores storyline, hits during the Charlotte storyline, and hits during the Elsie Bernard storyline, which is a really like in an episode that I think has too much and is too confusing, is a really tidy way of just being like, these things are all happening at once, you know? And that's a comfort to know, because this has been such a scattered season. So it's like, okay, let's bring these three storylines together all in one episode, you know?
Indeed. All right, let's move on to the Maeve storyline. The last we saw of her, she was doing a kind of Firestarter / Eleven from Stranger Things type deal where she's taking all these dudes' bodies. And it's like dawn. There's all these dead Japanese fighters. They look over the carnage and then cut out Sakura's heart. And Maeve wraps it up in her sleeve. And as that's happening, like as kind of Akane is tending to Sakura, Maeve's like having a flashback to her own daughter. And the hand motion is the same, right? That she makes to her daughter's face. As with many things, the Shogun world storylines and behaviors mimic many of the Westworld storylines. They travel to this other place where, what's his name? Musashi faces off against Tanaka in a duel for honor, and Musashi allows Tanaka to execute himself and then cuts his head off. And then Akane says to Maeve, you must find your child before this darkness eats us all alive. Let's just pause here for a moment. I thought this is a fairly effective fight scene. The gentleman who plays Musashi is actually very skilled at sword fighting in reality. I went back and watched the kind of Making a Shogun world and Hiroyuki Sanada did many of his own stunts, and so I think that's very convincing. But I mean, I think generally, Joanna, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like in general, when we watch these shows like Game of Thrones or Westworld, the action elements are often the least interesting parts of the show. They're well executed, they're well done technically, but like it's not really what brings us to these shows. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that like if you're going to go to Shogun World, giving us some beautiful fight choreography seems to be part and parcel of it. I mean, I think in Westworld, it's like gunslinging.
Right.
Who kind of cares about that, you know? But I'm glad they did this fight, even though there's so much of this episode that feels like sort of weird and loose and like it doesn't belong.
Yeah.
I don't mind that they took the time for this. I thought it was like really brilliant. I think it would have been even more effective if it were like if we knew the antagonist at all and if we cared even more about the Musashi character, who we do like, but we've only known for one episode. So it's not like this is a big fight. You know, this is not like some Game of Thrones fight where we know both of the combatants and we're invested on one side or the other. You know what I mean? It's like it's beautiful, but like, where exactly is our emotional investment? And did we have attention? Like, did we really think the Musashi was going to die? And what does death even mean on the TV show Westworld anyway? You know what I mean? Like we get the death of a character, Sakura, in this episode. They like choose to not bring her back, even though they could, because that's what Akane wants. Like what Akane believes is right. She's trying to preserve the reality of her world. But still, I just think that the Musashi fight, for as cool as it was, and Hiroyuki Sanada said that like the two swords were an homage to the real Musashi. Like that's all really interesting and cool and beautiful, but like leaves me a little cold because of that lack of emotional investment. So
agreed completely. And by the way, Sakura's heart, like, is it a human heart? Cause it looked pretty human to me. Is it a robot heart? Like what?
It's a robot heart. I think we've established at this point, like all their innards, they're like 3D printed. Like all their innards are like, you know, basically almost identical except for what's in their head, I guess.
Yeah. It looked very lifelike to me. That's all.
It sure did. That's true.
Anyway, moving on. Maeve, Akane, Musashi, Hanario, Lee, Felix, Sylvester, Hector, they all go to put Sakura's heart to rest. Felix and Sylvester go down a hatch, presumably to scout out a safe way out of here. Musashi and Akane decide to stay. Hanario goes with the whole crew. Was it distracting to you that no one had like a wet nap to wipe off Maeve's face, which had like blood all over it? I thought that was like a weird, really weird visual.
I don't know. I kind of liked that. Like both Akane and Maeve were just sort of like blood spattered for a lot of this episode. I liked it. So.
It was just interesting. It was kind of distracting. I was like, why wouldn't someone have just kind of like wiped it off by that? Because it is wiped off later in the episode. So anyway, random observation. Okay. So I was stunned at this scene, Joanna, because my reaction to this scene was, that's it in terms of Shogun World? We did get an email from Aaron, who writes into decodingwestworld@gmail.com. I listened to your discussion about Shogun World with interest and wanted to follow up on the discussion you had about why is this part of Maeve's story taking place in Shogun World? I have a theory for you. Maeve had to go to Shogun World to get enlightened. The Edo period in Japan is strongly tied to Zen Buddhism. At the beginning of the episode, we see a Zen monk meditating on a doorstep. This is, by the way, the previous episode that Aaron's referring to. Enlightenment in Zen Buddhism is often referred to as Kensho, which translates into seeing one's true nature. While it's notoriously hard to describe, Kensho is the true recognition of oneself, an understanding that there is no barrier, no distinction between what I know as me and every other element of the universe. I'm sorry, no self. And understanding that there's no barrier, no distinction between what I know as me and every other element of the universe. While Maeve is fighting the ninja, something changes in her. She sees her true self. Her struggling and pain stops. She no longer needs to fight. Nothing can hurt her. She has transcended her physical form and has a moment of deep calm. She's experienced Kensho. In doing so, she unlocks the ability to communicate wordlessly with other hosts, accessing the shared interconnection that exists beneath their physical bodies. In this way, she is enlightened. In short, Maeve had to go to Shogun World because it was the only place she could attain enlightenment, end quote. That email comes from Aaron to decodingworldsworld@gmail.com. And yeah, I mean, I think this whole time we've been trying to figure out what is with this whole Shogun World diversion? Like, what is the purpose of bringing us to this place other than, you know, a very fun, interesting, diverting story with lots of good action and very atmospheric production design and good performances from all these actors we don't normally see on screen? Is there any broader thematic purpose to this? And certainly Aaron raises one thing, possibility, right? And kind of does a lovely job of interpreting like that, like the function of this location for Maeve's story. Another thing that I alluded to last week, and that actually was corroborated by Lisa Joy in the kind of the behind the scenes discussion of this episode or these two episodes, is the idea that there are narratives that persist amongst cultures, right? And that you see how the, you know, gunslinger or cowboy narrative, Western narrative, has all these echoes with shogun, samurai narratives in Japan, and like this is a way of visually establishing that, making that connection. General Robinson, any other thoughts about, like, for me, it feels like, oh my gosh, that was like you spent tens of millions of dollars recreating Shogun World just for this, you know, like it feels like just a lot of work for a realization that Maeve could have achieved through other means. But what are your thoughts? If this is the last we see of Shogun World, what do you think of it?
I think I want to like sort of take back something I think I said on this podcast last week, which was like, it felt like the Wes Anderson film Isle of Dogs exists just because Wes Anderson wanted to make a movie about Japan. Yeah. And I kind of feel like Jonah Nolan and Lisa Joy just wanted to make some episodes about Japan.
Yeah.
And I do really love Aaron's email and sort of like digging into thematic reasons why it exists. And I do like Shogun World a lot. I am disappointed if this is the last we see of it, though.
Yeah.
So I wanted more from it and more from those characters. We kept one character,
right,
from Shogun World.
The one Hanario, who speaks the least, right?
Right. The mute one. But, you know, who knows? Never say never. You know, there's a reappearance of this episode. I definitely didn't. And hoped wouldn't happen. So we might see Shogun World again.
Yeah, but it does feel like, wow, if that was it, that seems like a whole bunch, yeah, of trouble for not that much payoff. You know,
right,
like it's again, really technically spectacular. Like everything, like what I would refer to as like below the line work, you know, production design, set dresser, like all that stuff. And even the actors are great. Like, but it's just like, just to make that point feels like, you know, just a lot of trouble for a fairly simple point. And I guess, you know, it was I certainly made the point effectively. It's just like, wow, it feels like you're setting this up to be a much bigger deal in the realm of the show that,
right,
may be coming to an end already. So, okay. So they appear in the plains of Westworld. They finally made it there. And Maeve has this lovely moment where she thanks Sizemore for his help. And Sizemore looks a little bit conflicted. Hector and Armistice want to go with her, but she says, no, I got to do this myself for plot convenience, I guess. And then Maeve goes running.
Yeah. stay here. The plot requires that you stay on this hill. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, kind of.
Yep.
No, it's okay. Emotionally, she needs to do it herself. She needs to do it herself, right? Okay, so let me ask you this, Joanna Robinson. I think we always knew that this would not be the lovely reunion that Maeve had imagined for herself. As she was going down and going to meet her daughter again, like, what did you think was going to happen? Like, I thought one of two things was going to happen. Either it was going to be some other woman is now this girl's mother, which turned out to be the case, or I thought it was going to be like some disturbing like clone Maeve was going to be her mother.
Ooh, that would have been fun and creepy.
Yeah, but what did you have any expectations like of what was going to happen when she met her daughter again?
I thought maybe it would be a different little actress playing the daughter. But I was like, that's going to be a hard thing to land, because even though we've seen that girl in flashbacks a number of times, I don't think we've seen enough of her that the audience will be like, oh, that's a completely different child. You know what I mean? Or like, maybe it's a little boy or something. Like, there's a have you seen the movie About Time?
Rachel McAdams.
Yeah. There's a reveal like that I actually think is truly horrifying in that movie.
I'm definitely got to rewatch that movie.
Lance was much more emotional impact than I think this moment did, because I'm like, what did you think, Maeve? Did you think that child was just out there on a homestead without a mother watching her? Like, Maeve looks surprised. Like, maybe the fact that the woman is styled to look like she did is shock enough. I think you're right. Like, a Maeve clone would have been more stunning, but obviously it wasn't going to be what she expected. I just don't understand how the Maeve character couldn't have expected that this was what it was going to be. Do you know?
Agreed. And I'm kind of baffled that Sizemore did not like prep her in some way. Do you know?
Right.
Because Sizemore explained everything else about it. He's like, yeah, we repurposed you to be this. You were wasted in that plot line and did it. Like, he should have said, like, by the way, or even Felix might have said, by the way, it's going to be really difficult because there's going to be another mother there. You know, like,
it just
is weird that none of them told her, because it feels like something you want to prepare her for, especially if she, you know, could potentially kill you, which seemed like it was on the verge of happening. In any case,
Ahead. The people in our chat are like, they've never used clones to replace, you know, like when they replaced Dolores's dad, they didn't use a clone. They used a different, like, we know that, like, obviously that's not standard practice. I'm just thinking of like what would be horrifying and unsettling for Maeve to uncover that she wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
And what she does uncover seems to me to be just like, exactly what you would expect to be happening. Do you know what I mean?
Agreed. Yeah. And it was mildly comical when she, like, her mom is the new mom is surrounded by the ghost station, and Maeve just like grabs the daughter and runs.
She's
like,
it just leaves her.
I'm your new mom now. You know, like, don't worry about that woman. Meanwhile, the daughter is probably like horrified. Yeah.
And that's the thing about this whole episode is like Shogun World, all the Shogun World stuff concludes and it's like so beautiful and so like everything works. And then as soon as they pop up out of that grave to the like homesteading section of the episode, none of this works for me. Like nothing Maeve does here works. Like,
say more about that. Yeah. Why doesn't it work for you?
I think like someone in our chat brought up like, okay, you can be as enlightened as you think you are, and then like PTSD kicks in and like your instincts take over. But like everything Maeve does here seems to be counter to the progress that she's made in terms of intelligence, in terms of enlightenment. And she's just like, she's not trying to communicate with Ghost Nation. She's not trying to like do any of the things that she's been doing. And she's just like freaking out and screaming and in a cowering position. And like, yes, I understand like the trauma of what she experienced, but like it's frustrating to me to watch her regress so completely. And it just feels like a mess, because especially since it's like, it's left dangling, like her posse comes down, Sizemore gets on the phone that he found to sort of get out of there. Sylvester obviously will want to go with him because Sylvester sucks in every way. Sizemore is at least conflicted about it. Felix goes down with Maeve, which is exactly what you would expect him to do. You know, so her posse winnows down to like four or something like that in theory. But I mean, what is this? What's happening? Like, what am I seeing? And like, we saw this from Maeve before, like when she encountered Ghost Nation, she got more frightened than we've seen her elsewhere. And I do respect that. And like, every time I talk about something like this, I feel like one of our listeners gets upset at me for not respecting enough the effects trauma can have on a person or a robot or whatever. And I do want to respect that. I'm just frustrated watching, what seems to me to be somewhat sloppy storytelling in this section when I've loved everything about Maeve all season. You know,
I thought this actually, I'm going to go to bat for this sequence.
Great.
And say, I actually, other than the part about her not expecting what was going to happen, like that was dumb, you know, I actually really liked the interaction that she had with her daughter. You know, I thought it was very touching, and about how she was going to protect, you know, the daughter from anything bad happening again. And then the ghost station shows up and they intone some, you know, very cryptic thoughts to her, right, about why, like, they should go with her, I think, right, is what they say, or something like that. Yeah, I mean, it just felt like, oh, okay, everything we're seeing about the Ghost Nation in the last few episodes is turning our idea of them on its head. You know, like, it's who, maybe it's not protecting them, but it's at the very least not harming them, you know? And so there is some subversion going on, and it's kind of continuing stuff that's happened previous episodes. So I didn't have a problem with it. I had problems with other things in this episode, but not this. So I thought it was worth it for that little moment that she had with her daughter alone. And it is in many ways the thing that we've been building up to for the last six episodes. Yeah, I thought it was decent.
It's also frustrating and hard, I guess, for me, because like we know at this point that Ghost Nation is not malicious. And yeah. So to like watch Maeve make such like a mistake, or I think they're not malicious, you know, they're yeah. certainly not being malicious to humans. I don't think they would be malicious to Maeve. This character who we've seen a number of times says to her, like, our paths, you know, we're on the same path or something like that. And she says, your path leads to hell, which is like, where are you? I don't know what she's talking. Well, I know what she's talking about, but anyway, it was frustrating for me. It seems to have worked for Plenty. And so that's good. That's fine.
All right. Speaking of things that are good and fine, Joanna, our listeners.
That's true.
Amazing segue. Who have donated to this podcast to make it so that we can spend 10 weeks talking about this extremely convoluted show. This podcast only exists because of people who helped us to kickstart it. And every week we like to thank a few of those people. Joanna, you want to take us through a few of these names we want to thank?
Yeah, they're not all names. All right. So Michael Bagdasarian, Patrick Byrne, Sarah Jenkins, Lori Faith Gibson, Mike Enos, Gary Taylor, John O.
Yep.
Hill.
Yep, John O. Hill, yep.
I feel like, sorry, okay, we'll talk about this later. Nikki Jones, Siren Ports, Tammy Lefko. All right, I got that one. Nice. All right, James Stout, Keita, Layla Lynn, Amy Reichert, Lydia Ashish, Celtic Kamanyu Boys in Green, Glasgow's Green and White, Heather Jones, Matt Tui, Michael Crowder from Frodsham, England. Yep.
I don't know what this means either.
It looks like it might be Welsh. Can I come back to this one?
Yeah, sure. No problem.
Okay.
I'll thank some people. Aubrey Iyer, Rich Gonzalez, Robert Boucher, Len Jacobs, Pablo Trejo, Rob Blunk, Andres Lucero, Jonathan Fuega, Allison Major, Chloe Bowen, Dylan G, James from Earlsfield, London, John Evans, Ben Glickman, Jeff Schiffman, Linda and Paul Abley, Mike Mestmaker, Meredith Locke, Nick Hurwich, Colby Rabideau, and Jeff Goldman. Thank you so much for your donations to the Kickstarter. Yep, go ahead, take it away, Jen.
All right, I believe that what is at the front of this is just an abbreviation for the title Counselor.
Nice.
So, Counselor Paul Williams.
Excellent. All right. Thanks to everyone for your contributions to the Kickstarter. You few hundred people made this whole podcast possible, and many, many tens of thousands of people listened, so we really appreciate it. Okay. Couple more plot lines to get to before we wrap up this episode. William is there with Lawrence and with his daughter. they're traveling through, you know, Westworld, and finally have an opportunity to meet. We see a little bit of how Emily is extremely savvy around the park. She says, like, oh, hey, those aren't real Ghost Nation arrows. Your men are looting a honeypot. Like, it's a trap, basically. And Emily and William have a chat by the fire where Emily reveals that she was invited to the gala and that she was happy to get to the Raj, which I think – is that the first official reference to the name of that park we've heard of? Or maybe it was brought up a couple episodes ago. Anyway. And in a key scene – this is the scene I cannot get out of my head, Joanna. William says that she was terrified of the elephants, but Emily contradicts him and says she loved them, that it was her mom, Juliet, that was scared by the elephants. Quote, she was never convinced this place couldn't hurt us, end quote. And
it is it the elephant? Wait. Is it the elephant detail that you can't get out of your head?
Yeah,
or
it's
what Juliet says. All right.
It's the look on William's face when she contradicts him. And it reminded me of this moment from the movie Ex Machina, which very – like minor spoiler, in Ex Machina, one of the characters at one point believes that he might be a robot, right? And starts cutting himself open to like to figure out if he's a robot or not. And it reminded me of that moment where like William is not sure if he's a host or not. Right. And that's just like there's all this stuff going on in his brain about like, wait, what does it mean that I misremembered?
See, I thought it was just a bad dad look, honestly. And yeah, Annie in the chat mentions what I was just about to say, which is this is a Donald Gleason movie double reference episode between About Time and Ex Machina.
Nice.
Okay. I like a lot of people are taking that to mean like maybe okay I like you I actually like your interpretation that he might think he's a host. A lot of theorists are saying like this is a clear indication he is a host, and I disagree. But Lord knows I've been wrong before. But like I thought it was just like meant to show what a bad dad he is, like that he can't remember who disliked the elephants. It's like that to me is classic bad dadding of like, well, one of you didn't like the elephants. It doesn't matter which one of you. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
Like
that interpretation did not even occur to me as a possibility. Yeah, I think it's equally likely that she's a host. I mean, I know it was proven that she wasn't a host.
It wasn't proven, but yeah. Like I think, and like I did talk about this at length on the other podcast, but like I think that if you have a scene where he's like, "Are you a host?" and she's like, "Fuck you, I'm not a host."
Right.
I think it's bad storytelling if Westworld then like JK, she's a host.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you know what I mean?
Agreed.
Like if he interrogates her directly about that and suspects that this is a trap that Ford has laid for him, I think it would be really dirty pool for Westworld to like pull a double reversal on that. But I don't know that I can claim that Westworld is innocent of dirty pool.
Exactly,
but
exactly.
Then I thought, why pass up the trip? I haven't been here in ages. Got a little, excited about going back to the Raj. It was always my favorite as a kid.
I remember. You were terrified of the elephants.
I loved the elephants. They scared the shit out of Mom. She was never convinced this place couldn't hurt us.
But I really felt like I loved this scene. In contrast to the Maeve stuff, I loved this fireside chat between Emily and William. I thought it was really effective. Her defensive bitterness, his vulnerability, like Ed Harris, like his eyeballs are gleaming through a lot of this scene with like unshed tears. I just thought it was really, really incredible. And to me, it didn't feel like this is a failure of a fidelity test or something like that. To me, it felt like this is a dad who's let his daughter down over and over and over again. And here he is again, like being like, oh, yeah, I have this shared memory. And she's like, you're wounded if you hear that your parent like doesn't even remember a basic thing about your childhood experience. Then you're alone in that childhood experience. Like that was my take on it. But I don't hate your take that he for a moment maybe thinks that he's a robot. I do dislike the take that this is like just some view. This only exists here in this scene to hint to all of us that he might be a robot. You know what I mean? I think it's more emotional and profound than that, but Yeah.
Interesting. I guess I would say that look that he has on his face is inscrutable, which I really like. I mean, I think you can read any number of interpretations. But when she contradicts him, he has this look on his face like he doesn't know what's going on, but he's trying to not tip his hand that he doesn't know what's going on. You know what I mean? Like, he's trying to not reveal that he doesn't know what's going on, and maybe trying to put things together in his mind. And that could mean anything. It could mean what you said about him being a bad dad. It could mean that maybe he suspects that he's a host. You know, like that he's trying to put it together. Like, am I a host? Like, did my backstory get messed up somehow? But the main thrust of the scene is like she's going to save him. Like, she doesn't want him to do some suicide by robot, as she calls it, on whatever kind of quest he's on. She doesn't want him to go through with it. She apologizes for saying like that her mom's death was his fault, and says like, you know, let's leave the park together tomorrow. And they seem to reconcile, and everything's going great. Then the next morning she wakes up and he's gone. This is not a optimal father-daughter relationship, it seems, right? I mean, a lot of bad dynamics going on here.
Did you, like, I believed him that he was going to go with her. But then, like, I thought, I as that scene concluded, I was like, he's going to go with her. But he's lying to her. But he's going to go with her. And then at the last minute, he's going to do something that requires him to stay behind the park. Like, he just can't quit. He can't leave. I did not see him just like abandoning her the next morning in a dangerous part of the park. Like, that's next level bad dadding. Even though we know she can take care of herself, that's pretty bad. So.
I mean, when they have that nice moment, basically anytime anyone has a nice moment in Westworld, prepare for it to be undercut. I mean, I think that's pretty true in general. Throughout the show.
Yeah.
Anytime someone gets too happy, like, hey, everything's going to be okay. Like, anytime someone says something like that, it's not going to be okay. Something terrible is going to happen, like, in general. So I knew something bad was going to happen, but I agree with you that I didn't expect it to happen so quickly. You know?
Right.
Like, I didn't expect it to happen, like, the next day he's already gone.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
People in the chat room here are saying like how much they like the scene, like Ed Harris's performance, Katya Herbers, who plays Emily, her performance, and are saying like maybe it's because this is like one of the only times we've seen William interact with a human. Mm. And I would say the last time we saw that was when he was talking to Ford, which I think is my other favorite Ed Harris performance in this show. So I don't know if Ed Harris like does something different when he's talking to humans versus robots, but I really love the show, and this is kind of what I want Westworld to be. Like these really loaded interactions, and low key, I guess I get annoyed about the elephant thing. Once again, not really your interpretation, but the other one, because like I don't even want any sort of like theorizing to invade this scene. I just want it to be like a scene between two human characters with like baggage and history and shared trauma, and like this whole, is he a robot? Is she a robot? It is interesting, but it's like the least interesting thing about the scene to me. So,
well, let me take us on a little digression, if I may, Joanna, and just talk a little bit about this episode overall. I mean, I found this to be an enormously frustrating episode. We're going to get into the last sequence and kind of how that ties in with the first in a moment, but I did find this to be a very frustrating episode. I think it's because so little is revealed, right? And like so many more questions are asked, and it's done in such a way to seemingly actively confuse the audience, you know? Mark Harris tweeted something that I thought was interesting, which is he said, I would like for season three for the showrunners of Westworld to do a self-challenge and present the story in chronological order, right?
Yeah.
And there are thematic reasons why presenting a story in non-chronological order is actually a benefit to the storytelling. Big example is Memento, which is something the Nolans have been involved with. Obviously, they wrote and directed that that film. And even in season one of Westworld, the realization that William and the Man in Black are the same person fits in with Dolores's fractured memory kind of revealing itself over time. In this season, you have kind of Bernard going through the same thing, losing time, flashing forward, flashing backward. Is this now? doesn't feel like it serves as much of a storytelling function. Like, or the storytelling function it serves seems to be only to deceive, inveigle, and obfuscate what the plot is, and to keep the audience guessing for no reason other than they want the audience to be trying to figure things out, and not necessarily because they want the audience to enjoy it more, or because they want the fractured storytelling to enrich the storytelling experience. What do you think?
I completely agree with you. I think there was this criticism in season one that it was like confusing for confusing sake, that Westworld just wanted to, like, to be oh so clever. And I was really defensive of the show against that. Like, I really defended season one, and I defended a lot of this season. And I think I'm frustrated with this episode because it, like, I think it makes a liar out of me. Like, I think this episode shows that there are ways in which the creators of the show are trying to, I think, as you said, like, obfuscate just to, like, keep us all on our back foot. And that, to me, sometimes can be interesting, but is not always interesting. And especially, as you say, when it doesn't serve the thematic purpose of the show. And right. So, like, there are still my favorite episode of the series to date is last week's Akane no Mai, which was largely divorced from any of this time twisty bullshit.
Yeah.
And it was just like a really emotional, beautifully acted, beautifully rendered story with some aside of Dolores. And I just, I want the show to be confident in itself that it can just be that. And it doesn't have to be quite so intentionally confounding, you know?
Yeah, I agree completely. Now, I do think there's still the possibility that the show may, quote unquote, redeem itself this season. You know, maybe at the end.
I agree.
It's all going to make, it's, oh, like, now I understood why you told it in such a fractured narrative.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's possible that that will happen.
And I mean, I think this time last season, I think 7 through 10, this is episode 6, right? I think 7 through 10, I was talking to Kim Renfro, who's doing really great work at Insider on Westworld this season, and she was at Con of Thrones, so she happened to be in the same hotel with me. Like, we both went up to our separate rooms, watched Westworld, wrote about it, then came back down the lobby and we're like, oh my god, this, and oh my god, that, and blah blah blah. And it was really fun because usually I'm by myself doing that. But she pointed out to me that 7 through 10 in season 1 were really strong.
Mm.
And so my hope is that 7 through 10 of this season will be really strong. I think 1 through 3 were a little funky. I think 4 and 5 were really strong. I think 6 is very funky. And I'm hoping episodes 7, 8, 9, 10 will be strong. So I'm not like throwing in the towel on the show at all by any stretch. I'm just frustrated to come off such like a steep climb in quality to this. Another thing that we should say about this episode that certainly adds to the intentionally confounding mix is I think it's the first episode this season that they try to check in with every single character. And that just adds to like your split focus. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you have to have Dolores, Maeve, Charlotte, Bernard, Elsie, William, like, got to check all those boxes. And I don't think you necessarily should have to do that in any given episode. And I think it adds to the fractured quality of it. Yeah.
So in one of the other podcasts I do, the Slash Filmcast, we have this big Slack, which has like over 1,000 members in it. Mm-hmm. At slackfilmcast.com, and there's a hashtag Westworld spoilers channel in it, and Mark Madel made this comment in the Westworld spoilers channel that I thought was kind of astute. He said, or not kind of astute, he says, the lack of high concept sci-fi through much of this season, with the Delos stuff being virtually the only exception, is one of the reasons, in my opinion, that this season is weaker. Slowly paced westerns and samurai films are fine if the fighting is what you tuned in for, but if you showed this episode, he's talking about last week's episode, Akane no Mai, to someone blind and minus the credits, it's possible they might think it was about some 19th century English-speaking travelers, one of whom has paranormal powers, that inadvertently got stuck in Japan during the Edo period, plus the American West narrative. And I thought, I was like, yeah, that is true. And you know the whole stuff about what's going on at Delos and the Mesa and all that, it's very easy to lose the strand. See what I did there? I've completely lost the strand. What is going on? The Strand, you see, because it's his name. Okay, anyway.
Do you feel like focusing more completely on it would make for like a narrative that's like a little heartier in Hale than what we're currently seeing?
Nice, nice. Okay. I did the alley-oop and you kind of like did the slam dunk, you know? I mean, on a serious note, I feel like all that stuff, all the modern sci-fi stuff that was a huge, like, all this stuff about, like, what's going on in the lab and all, it just gets lost. Like, the present day stuff has gotten completely lost to me. You know what I mean? And I guess that's okay because we're concentrating on this other stuff, but it feels like the show is having a difficult time balancing all the different timelines. And it's trying to keep all these balls in the air. And if you don't, if you don't keep all these plates spinning, then I just start to care less about the plates that you're not spinning anymore. And like, what is going on with Strand? What's going on in present day? I don't even. Right. It's been many episodes since we have had any movement on that front. So anyway, perhaps episodes 7 through 10 will help tie it together. We will see. But let's bring this episode home. Elsie and Bernard. What is going on with Elsie and Bernard? They are kind of, you know, teamed up, reunited. They're going through the park, and they get to the hat area of the park, right? Like the place where you know William chose his hat.
Yeah, the hat room.
The hat room. That room.
I thought it was kind of fun to see the reverse. You know, like when William goes into the park in season one, he's like, he gets his hat, he walks down that door, hallway, he opens the door, and then all of a sudden he's on a train, like going through a tunnel. To see them just like walk down into the train tunnel and then through that door is just kind of like, because it seemed like an optical illusion almost, what happens to William in season one. And so to see them just do the physical retread of that, even though we already saw like Bernard go through that tunnel in the present storyline, like it was still just fun to see Bernard and Elsie do that, and to see that QA, to see the reverse shot of that hall, and to see the all the intake hosts, and you know, the point being that QA, the guys in black, have gone completely over the top if they're just killing the intake hosts, who, I mean, I guess according to Elsie are harmless, but then again, Angela was an intake host, so once upon a time. So,
yeah, anyway. Exactly. I think it's a completely reasonable course of action.
Marina Midori in the chat says, "Was there a significance to the face close up they showed of the guy on the floor?" She says it looked like Sizemore. It did not look like Sizemore to me. Someone I know thought it might be Jonathan Nolan. Something we haven't talked about on the show is that Ramin Djawadi actually had a cameo in episode 4 or episode 3 or 4. He was in the. He was in the town with the man in black and Craddock. He was playing the guitar. You know, they did do a close up on his face, but he has like facial hair, so I didn't recognize him. But that seemed to be a similar shot to me. They do like a slow pan around this guy on the floor. Unless it was a cameo of someone that I don't know who it was, I have no answers for you, because it didn't look like a character we know to me. So, yeah.
Also, during this scene, Elsie says the phrase, "macho fucks are probably loving this shit," which I thought was an unintentional meta commentary about who enjoys most those scenes of ruthless slaughter at the Delos or at the, inside the Mesa, which I found to be not particularly interesting in season one. And there's obviously a lot more of it this season as well. So anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. So moving on, they are trying to get to the cradle because it's revealed that so a big concept is introduced this episode, right? The cradle.
Yeah.
And it is basically a magical exposition device that explains everything that's going on in the park. Elsie gives an explanation. Let's see if I can find it here. She says, QA has been trying to regain control of whatever Ford did to the system, and they were actively blocked every time by the cradle. The cradle can't influence the Mesa's infrastructure. It's just the host's backups. It can simulate park narratives, but it can't influence the other systems. Well, look at this. The cradle's influenced interface with nearly every discrete system in the entire park in the last 7 days. Every time these idiots upload a hack, it's responding in like a totally different way. It's like there's something in here that's improvising. The cradle's fighting back. So that's what she says. So basically, it's like this place where they keep a backup of all of the personalities in the park, right? Like,
yeah, there's a 5-minute video that HBO released about the cradle.
Yep.
And that's like kind of annoying to me, because I feel like even though this podcast often serves as a footnote for various things that happen in the show, it's annoying to me to introduce a concept that you need a 5-minute explainer video to try to like further land with your audience. But, you know, they, Jonathan Nolan interviewed in that video says stuff like the hosts always have another version of their mic co-located in the cradle, that they take hours of refinement and that's where they do it. He's like, what happens when you lose one of these things? Maybe one of the mind eggs, one of the pearls, as they call it. What's the backup? The backup is in the cradle. So the cradle itself, but the cradle is operating in a way. And we should point out that the cradle is spelled really stupidly. It's CR4-DL.
I thought that was fine. I mean, I think like CR4-DL is like the technical room number or whatever, and they just called it the cradle as an abbreviation was my interpretation of that. So
okay, yeah. That makes me feel a little bit better.
I didn't think this was like a Terminator Genesis situation.
I don't like leet speak. Like,
Well, then so, I guess you didn't like Han Solo's Star Wars story. Anyway, okay. The cradle, Elsie is charging through so much exposition in this episode, and she does like Shannon Woodard does a valiant effort, but it is just a formidable amount of exposition for anyone to get through. And I think you're right that a lot of it is lost. Like, I don't know that, like, she just casually introduces this major thing. And then, by the way, this major concept that I had not introduced until now is behaving in a way that is counter to how it's supposed to behave, which I just introduced a second ago. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like pretty inelegant, in my opinion. But that being said, you know, they plug Bernard into the cradle.
Right.
Presumably to do what exactly? Like to stop?
So he can interface directly with it and figure out what's inside of it that's behaving this way.
That's right. That's right. And then we have, a massive surprise, which is that we see Ford, played by Anthony Hopkins, is in the cradle, right? Were you expecting this? Did you hear about the surprise casting before?
Surprise casting? I did not know until this episode that it would be him. I didn't know until I saw the dog. So he goes into Sweetwater. He's like in the teddy position on the train going to Sweetwater, gets off. It's like Sweetwater in its like most idealized, pre-tampered, you know, there's Dolores looking sweet. There's Teddy looking nice. Milk can presumably going to be dropped any minute now, blah, blah. And then you see the dog and, you know, Ford had that famous speech about Greyhound. And I was just like, oh, fuck. It's Anthony Hopkins. Gotta be Anthony Hopkins. I mean, I guess I kind of thought when Elsie was like, something's fighting back, I was like, well, that seems like Ford. And then Bernard says this stuff about like, we had mentioned Arnold as a Ford as a possibility of like who he had printed that red pearl for a couple episodes
ago. So our interpretation as a result of this scene is that the mind egg / chestnut / whatever that he printed in that lab and then killed everyone, That is Ford. That is our conclusion from this, right?
That is Ford, and he dropped it into the cradle, and that's how Ford is in the cradle.
Right.
So it's not that, like, Ford has done exactly what Jim Delos did. Ford instead decided to put himself in the cradle. And, like, he had that line when he died in season one where he goes, Beethoven and Chopin, they just became music, right? So Ford has become code, essentially. And I don't think he intends to have a body, you know? Like, that was the whole theory, is that, like, he was printing a body so that he could live, immortally that way. I don't think that's his intention. I think his intention is to, like, control everything. And this explains some of your questions that you've had, Dave, about like, how is it that Ford's able to anticipate like what William would do? Like, how did he leave this really elaborate game behind, you know, blah, blah. And the answer is like, he's still going inside the machine.
He's still pulling the strings. It sounded like you were disappointed at seeing Ford, right? It sounded like you didn't greet this development with much joy.
I love Anthony Hopkins, and I think he's great in the show. So, like, you know, that's fine. And I don't think it's going to last because Betty Gabriel's character, Ma Ling, says in episode 3, like, someone took out the cradle. So in the present storyline, the cradle has been destroyed.
Yeah.
So whatever this is, it's like a three to four episode device, you know? Like, we don't have to worry that it's going to just, like, the rest of the series takes place inside the cradle or anything like that. But, you know, the thing we should note, obviously, is that when Bernard goes into the cradle, the aspect ratio changes.
Yeah.
So, in theory,
to match the same aspect ratio as the first scene.
Right. So in theory, this is the visual indication the show is using to tell the audience you're in the Matrix, you're in the cradle. So then we have to go back and think about that first scene in the context of that and what that means.
So I actually think it was great to see Ford again because, you know, Anthony Hopkins tweeted. Anything Anthony Hopkins tweets, Joanna, is canon, right? So right. When Anthony Hopkins tweeted, like, it was a great honor of my life to play Dr. Ford, it's like, oh, Anthony Hopkins is not doing Westworld anymore. But we see Anthony Hopkins in this episode. It doesn't seem like it's old footage. It seems like it's actually him or a new scene or something net new that was shot. And I'm like, oh, wow, he really tricked us all. Right. And I appreciate when, you know, an actor can pull a fast one like that. So
whereas I get irritated.
Fair enough. Totally reasonable reaction, Joanna. Totally reasonable reaction. So, but yeah, I was like, oh, that you're incorrigible, Anthony Hopkins. You're incorrigible. That was my reaction. But that delight was quickly replaced by blinding rage because I'm at a loss to make sense of what's actually happening in this episode. The first scene between Dolores and Bern Arnold, whoever it is, seems to be Dolores training a new Bernard host to go into the world, right? Like in the past when we've seen Fidelity mentioned, it's with William trying to see if Jim Delos would be a suitable host that could go out into the world and leave the lab.
Right.
But if this all takes place in the cradle, then that doesn't make any sense. Like, why would she need to – is she training a code version of Bernard? Like, you're introducing this brand new concept of, oh, you need to train the code as well. You know, and it's just like – I guess I thought that the host being a part of a body, like that was part of the cognitive plateau that they referred to. Like it's right. Something about the fusion of mind, egg, and host body that makes it difficult – for it to kind of survive in the real world. And now it seems like that might not be the case. You know what I'm saying? Like, and so it just is really confusing to me and disorienting. And like, I feel like I pay close attention to this show and I'm being betrayed by it or not betrayed, but it's like, hey, the show is doing things that like, even I can't understand right now. And again, as we've discussed, there's times when that can work for the show, but it just felt like being opaque for the sake of being opaque in this case. What do you think?
So here are some thoughts. One common theory is that in the Dolores interrogation scene that we see, that's not actually Dolores, that it's Ford posing as Dolores. So we might get like, find out that in the cradle you can just like make yourself look like whoever you want to look like, which just makes me want to cry thinking about it. I don't like that at all, because if you rewatch that scene, she goes, no, he never said that to me. And I don't know, it just seems very like personal to Dolores, of like disappointment of like, I'm trying to recreate this Arnold and you're failing me, Bernard version of Arnold. Like, no, he never said that. You know, like he felt this and that and the other thing, you know? And so it like, it doesn't feel like Ford as, Dolores to me. But what does it mean that there is a clever Dolores inside the cradle? Like, because the version of Dolores that we see inside in the cradle in this episode seems to me to be like the farmer's the rancher's daughter, you know? So how does the smarter version of Dolores's mind get inside the cradle? Is there another Dolores in there?
Is that the same Dolores, right, that you saw earlier, right?
Will we see her you know, uploading herself just like Bernard did in this episode? I think it's very convenient that there's a Bernard sitting in that cradle room with like an empty head. And so I like the idea possibly of like a Dolores, whatever you own, this version of Dolores, this Wyatt version of Dolores going inside the cradle, training the Arnold thing, training his brain. And then the pearl that shoots back out is more Arnold than Bernard, you know? Yeah. I don't know why she would do that. Well, she said she was disappointed that Bernard was not more like Arnold. Yeah. That was something that she was disappointed by. But what trips me up there, if that's the case, I don't know how time works in the cradle.
Right.
But which, Like, it drives me crazy. There's like no rules. It's like time can flow however you want. Anyone could maybe look however they want. Like, the rulelessness of it is like causing me to break out in hives. But
yeah,
like,
yeah.
If time doesn't pass the same way, then maybe, you know, because she's like, we've conducted this test countless times. And like, so there's not that much time between when, in theory, a Dolores could go in there and Arnold Mind Egg could come out. So what's going on there? I don't know. I don't know, Dave, Chen, what's happening. I don't know why that conversation is taking place inside the cradle. Hold on.
Let's pause here for a moment, Joanna, and say that it's distinctly possible that that conversation is not taking place inside the cradle. Right? It's
no, I reject. There has to be some kind of order in all of this.
Your belief is that that conversation takes place in the cradle because it's the same aspect ratio as like the last scene in the cradle is the same aspect ratio as the opening scene with Dolores and Bern Arnold, right?
Like, yeah.
That's why you think it happens in the cradle, because the same aspect ratio.
Yeah.
I think that's a very reasonable assumption, but I also that's the thing. It's so ruleless that I feel like the show could, anytime it's in a different aspect ratio, it's actually just Bernard's perception of it. You know, like it could be anything. Like, it could mean anything, Joanna.
I'm swimming in a sea of dead robot bodies. Chris Woodrow in our chat says, Ford solved how to solve for fidelity. He uses the cradle to run fast simulations and produce the solve pearl into Arnold's body. So, like, instead of taking years and years and years to run these Delos fidelity tests, you fast forward it because time works however the fuck you want in the cradle. And and then someone else, who was it? Who brought up Inception? Oh, AA in the chat. I was thinking about this too when I was mentioned Inception earlier. AA in the chat says, Inception rules mean tons of time in the cradle could pass, and that could be 5 real minutes. Because in the film Inception, like, the farther down you go in the layers, the slower time or the faster time. Anyway, time works differently. So they could be in the simulation of the cradle for thousands of years, and it could only be a minute in the real time of the park. We don't know. So, but I think what feels clear to me, even though you're right that we're living in like a lawless society, but like what feels clear to me is that whatever's inside Bernard's head when he washes up on the beach in episode 1 of the season is created inside the cradle by someone with knowledge of Arnold. And there are Arnold-like tendencies in him. Whether he is exactly Arnold, whether it is like the human consciousness of Arnold, I don't know where they would have gotten that, or just like retraining Bernard to behave, to have the memories of Arnold, to behave more like Arnold. But what I do know is that once again, the show has sort of like pulled the wool over our eyes in that we're not looking at, you know, we thought in season 1, when we saw those Arnold and Dolores scenes in that like glass box in the lab, that we were looking at Bernard and Dolores in present time. We were looking at Arnold and Dolores in the past. We thought we were looking at Bernard and Dolores in present time. And then in this season, we're like, okay, now we got it. We got it now. We're looking at Arnold and Dolores in the past. And they're like, no, you're looking at Bern Arnold and Code Dolores in the timeless air realm of the cradle. Like,
double reversal
for that. Like, what is happening? I don't know.
I mean, okay, so I think if we interpret what's happened chronologically, right, what's happened is Bernard goes into the cradle, finds Ford. At some point, Ford is going to introduce Bernard to Wyatt Dolores in the cradle, and then Dolores will run like 500 million simulations with Bernard. My mind is breaking. Like, Bernard is already there. Why does she need another? Like, maybe she's creating a separate version of Bernard, right?
Like, she wants an Arnold. She wants an Arnold version. She wants someone in the chat brought up all the daddy issues that we've got going on in the park, and like when she was dealing when Dolores, the rancher's daughter, is dealing with Abernathy. Like, that's a father daughter connection, but there is a part of Dolores. There's like the father-daughter connection of the rancher's daughter and her father, Wyatt, whatever. And then there's like the other Dolores, the robot Dolores, the Dolores that doesn't have a Southern accent. Like, and her father is Arnold.
Right.
And we saw that like in the opening episodes of the season when she like goes to his house and he's talking to her like she's his child and stuff like that. Like they have always had this father-daughter connection. So her wanting to resurrect Arnold makes a lot of sense to me. That she would want to do it in the middle of this like robot rebellion, I don't know.
Cradle Dolores wants to do it, maybe, right? Cradle version of Dolores, not the...
Does that mean Cradle version of Dolores gets the same updates that in the body version of Dolores is? So, like, she is already, like, that smart inside
Cradle? I don't know about that, but maybe... But clearly Ford is pulling the strings, so maybe Ford is, like, moving both Dolores's forward in tandem. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, maybe it's Ford's doing that, like, Cradle Dolores is, like, trying to build an Arnold version of Bernard for reasons beyond our comprehension right now. Who later shows up on the beach. I don't know, dude.
So, like, it's I do want to have some meta commentary on this, which is, like, when this episode ended, Kim Renfro and I, like, both went on Twitter and, like, expressed some frustrations with it. And like, a bunch of people are like, well, maybe have you tried reading Reddit? It's like, yeah, like, both of us read Reddit. Of course we read it. Like, we spend so much time studying the show. Yeah. We are both not stupid people. And Dave had a similar, like, Dave was like, David Chen hosts a podcast about this. You study it week by week. You're not a stupid person. Like, this, it shouldn't be this confounding. And I don't think I'm too stupid to understand what the show is doing. I think the show has gone too far in its unhooking from a thread that we can follow. And like me, and maybe you, the listener, think I am too stupid and like I'm just not following Westworld anymore, but I swear to you, like I loved the twistiness of season one, and this maybe will all like just be crystallize a bit more in the next episode. I'm not giving up on the show. I'm not throwing in the towel. Everyone in the chat room is really concerned for my mental health. I'm fine. I'm just frustrated that they've introduced this like really like this, put this spanner in the gears of something that was already like hard enough to track, you know, frustrating. Yeah.
It would be, you know, a visual way to think of it is like if the first season was, you know, a piece of wood that was broken in half that, like, meets in the middle. You know, it's because it's, like, two timelines that, like, meet in one. Like, this season, it's, like, that same piece of wood has, like, splintered into, like, 10 different pieces. And you're, like, trying to, like, follow, like, okay, how do these connect? And, like, does this even relate with this? Are these happening at the same time? It just – it has, like, spiraled into such complexity. And again, maybe, Joanna, there's some way that the showrunners are going to tie this together in a way that's like immensely satisfying at the end. And oh, that's why you spent like three episodes confusing us. It's because you wanted to, in service of this broader goal, you know, like maybe, but I'm not hopeful that that's going to happen. I think you're right. Like, this is the episode that I'm like, okay, I don't get it anymore. You know, like I'm willing to like accept a lot of uncertainty and a lot of unknown stuff, but I'm just like, this is like too much. This one's too much for me. So
this episode is too much, but I won't say this season is too much. And I'm really hoping that like it just it solidifies a bit more next week. And I understand that it's working for some people and they're really happy about it. Raymond Terry, who I consider like one of our sharpest listeners who always like come like corrects me on things, says like in our chat, he's like, I got no issue with this. And also like, I don't think the aspect ratio is the cradle. Okay. Like maybe not. Maybe who knows? Let's all just like strap in. But I am sorry because like I think people come to me like looking for clarity on the show.
I'm one of them.
And like I feel like I have some clarity, but not in full clarity for you this week. So
I guess I don't understand Raymond's comment about like the aspect ratio doesn't mean the cradle, because at the end it is in the different aspect ratio. So like I mean, that's kind of my point, is that I think clearly the ending is meant to denote that Bernard is in the cradle, right? Like, that's feels like it's beyond dispute.
Yeah.
But you never know. And so the question is just whether or not the opening scene indicates that it's also in the cradle because it's in that aspect ratio. That is the big question for me. Because if the answer is yes, that they're both in the cradle, then that like that helps to orient me. It's still pretty confusing, but it helps to orient me. But if the aspect ratio is just like...
Means nothing.
Then it's like, or means something that we haven't considered yet, right? That's very possible.
Yeah.
Then, you know, It's really confusing. It's really confusing. So, and as a result, it's hard to evaluate this episode because you don't even know what is actually happening. Right.
Right. And that's something that people complained about in season one. And I was defensive of it. And this season, I'm like, I kind of feel you on it.
Yeah.
So,
kind of. Yeah. That's exactly how I feel. It's not like the show is terrible, though. It's just like, kind of feel you that it's a little too confusing for its own good.
Yeah. And Ryan in the chat is like, says, like, I think it would be a real weird move to not keep all the Letterboxd scenes in the same reality. And I just really agree. If you're going to use it for the first time ever, and it's for two different things, this like Dolores Arnold chat or Bernard Arnold, whoever. Yeah. Jeffrey Wright and Evan Rachel Wood are having a chat in one aspect ratio. And Jeffrey Wright inside the cradle is in that same aspect ratio. And nothing else in the show is in that aspect ratio. Like, why wouldn't those things be connected?
Agreed. You know? So. Agreed. It would be a very bizarre decision that the show may or may not make. You never know. Okay. Well... you know, we've tried to hash it out as best as we can on this episode of Decoding Westworld, and I have a feeling, like, you know, here's what I'll say, Joanna. In defense of the show, I felt like season one tied up a lot of the loose ends, right, of season one. Like, the season one finale answered a lot of the questions. And so my hope is that the end of season two, like, I don't think we're going to be left wondering what's up with the aspect ratio by the end of season two. Because otherwise, at that point, I am going to go, like, full rage on the show. You know what I'm saying? Like,
oh, get ready. Yeah.
But I have faith that we're going to get answers to these questions. And I have hope, but not faith, that the answers will be satisfying. So, okay. Any closing thoughts? If not, let's wrap it up. Find more episodes of the show at decodingwestworld.com. Email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out Paul Scheer and Amy Nicholson's new podcast, Unspooled. They're watching the 100 all-time greatest movies and discussing them with film experts. Find that podcast in apps like Stitcher and on Apple Podcasts right now. Joanna Robinson, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
I can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you and say Joanna's being far too modest, because you can actually find her on the cover of Vanity Fair.
Well, not me on the cover.
Yeah, I mean, you know, your name on the cover.
Sure.
Joanna had the cover story on Vanity Fair. You did an interview with Amelia Clark, right?
I did do that. Yeah.
Super cool. It was so awesome to see that. And so I just wanted to give a shout out to that. Anyway,
Thank you. You can find my byline on the cover of Vanity Fair. You can find me at vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
Find me on Twitter at Dave Chensky, that's Dave Chen SKY, and youtube.com/Dave Chensky, that's Dave Chen SKY. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.